From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of The New Yorker, where journalists Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow published a piece detailing allegations of physical and sexual assault committed by New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Just hours later, after the publication, Schneiderman resigned, although he denies that he did anything wrong. He joins the many political leaders who have lost their careers amidst abuse allegations, especially since this past October. Schneiderman had positioned himself as an ally in the Me Too movement. He vowed to go after Harvey Weinstein, and now he faces the same kind of opprobrium. Well, this hour, we're going to approach this from several different angles. Later, we'll talk about the ways that powerful people, usually men, hurt women. They use their advantage, their power, to do that. In our first half hour, we're going to look at New York State's political culture that has produced a stream of twisted and abusive men, again, if you believe the allegations. Writing for the New Republic, Jeet Hare says, quote, New York politics are very male-dominated, a gender disparity that might explain why sexual harassment is so common. An Associated Press investigation in January found that New Yorkers have paid more than $10 million over the last 9 years to settle 88 cases of sexual harassment, discrimination, and related cases in state government, almost all of which were brought by women reporting groping, come-ons, and demeaning treatment. And Politico has reported that more than 1,000 people have complained of sexual harassment in New York State government entities since 2012 alone, costing taxpayers at least $6.4 million in legal settlements there. A lot to talk about here. My guests include on the line with us Karen DeWitt, WXXI's Capital Bureau Chief. And Karen, welcome back to the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Sure thing, Evan.
Wes Renfro is in studio with us, an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at St. John Fisher College. Wes, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Megan DeChanteauvieux is director of development and marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. Megan, welcome to you
Thank
as
you.
Well. What I want to do is I want to play a soundbite here of Eric Schneiderman talking about going after Harvey Weinstein. And this, knowing the allegations against Schneiderman, and if you believe them, and in this case, it is hard not to, it takes on a whole different tone if you listen to Eric Schneiderman talking about Harvey Weinstein.
We have investigated other companies for patterns of sexual discrimination or harassment. We have never seen anything as despicable as what we've seen here. As set forth in our petition, the conduct really was shocking. There's a lot of language used there that I'm not going to use, but some of the citations to things that Mr. Weinstein said to employees, the pattern of abuse, the use of employees to manipulate his targets or victims of sexual harassment is just really astonishing. The fact that he had a group of employees who were responsible for cleaning up his office after sexual encounters, including returning articles of clothing to the women who left them behind, is really something that should be shocking to anyone. And it is clear that this was done in violation of the law.
I mean, Karen DeWitt, you listen to that now, and then you read the New Yorker piece, and you wonder, are voters ever going to trust politicians, but especially men in power again? I mean, how do you feel about this, Karen?
Yeah, I know. I think that is pretty shocking. And what I was the only thing I was thinking rather sarcastically was, well, what Eric Schneiderman's accused of, at least he didn't have, like, his office help participate in his abuse, right? But no, people are really just, it's just hard. Nobody can wrap their heads around this at this point, because the hypocrisy of it is just what is so stunning. If he was someone that was, you know, known to, you know, have kind of a violent streak or just seemed like a, you know, a nasty kind of person, you know, maybe you would believe it of him more. But yeah, he was just a champion for women. He, in public, he was always nice to women. He dated a lot of women. I mean, we know now maybe more what that was about. And, you know, he participated in, you know, against domestic violence. One of his first jobs was he escorted women to Planned Parenthood clinics to protect them from protesters. So that's why people are just having a really, really hard time comprehending this, although the way the New Yorker article reads, with so much, you know, documentation and talking to other witnesses who the women told things at the time, it just, it seems very believable to people. And Karen, on that level.
And Karen, before the hour began, you were telling us about a woman that you spoke to who I think had done some work with the state attorney general and now is appalled by the. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's going to be in my news story later today. She had the domestic violence, anti-domestic violence program in New York City. Her organization helped then-Senator Schneiderman craft a bill that would make choking someone illegal. And to now find out that he allegedly did that regularly, she just cannot believe it. It's just a stunning, stunning betrayal of, you know, who they thought he was. She was at a press conference with him last fall where they were talking about, you know, helping, you know, victims of domestic violence. And so that just even seems even odder and even more stunning.
I want to read a little bit from more from Jeet Harris' piece in the New Republic. And his piece was about the toxic nature of New York state politics. He writes, quote, Schneiderman, who has denied the allegations but resigned nonetheless, is not just another powerful man brought down in the Me Too era. He's a prime example of a specific phenomenon, the immoral New York politician. The state and its namesake city seem to produce more than their share of men who abuse their political power, whether for financial gain, career advancement, or the mistreatment of women. And this is neither just a regional problem nor a strictly partisan one. New York has always had an outsized influence on national politics. Although Democrats are dominant in the state, the current president is very much a product of this political culture, too. New York's toxic politics are further poisoning Washington's politics, and yet it may take other New York politicians to clean it up. I'll start with you, Karen, on that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the New York culture. There's big egos. It's very high stakes politically. Still seen to be attorney general or governor as a stepping stone to be president. I mean, look at our current president. Was New York real estate developer from Queens. He didn't go the typical political route, but I think they aim higher, and it attracts a certain kind of a personality, a certain kind of ruthlessness, a certain kind of, you know, I'll do whatever it takes to get ahead and not really think about, you know, maybe some of the moral dilemmas, to say the least, that you're going through. And we have seen a lot of it. Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, you know, the corruption of the two former legislative leaders who were convicted of corruption, though they did get it overturned on appeal. But they are, right now, the former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver is facing a new trial in federal district court. He led a double life, if you believe the charges. He was stealing from people all the time while acting like, you know, he was for tenants' rights and rights of the people. And, you know, he was this kindly kind of grandfatherly-like figure. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I find being a reporter here. It's we know so little about the kind of double lives that it's revealed that a lot of these people have. And that's, you know, you kind of wonder, are we, you know, we're in the building of the reporters, myself and print reporters, news organizations. Are we the most naive people in the Capitol that we just never see this until some prosecutor comes along? You know,
I don't think you're naive at all, Karen. I think you're like one of the most clear-eyed people in Albany. And but you're right. I mean, to some degree, we think we know people and we don't know people. You know, we know their public personas. And let me turn to Wes Renfro on that last line from Jeet Hare. He says it may take other New York politicians to clean it up. I mean, if that's the case, I think that's why people are so cynical. They don't believe that that's going to happen. What do you make of that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's an unending string of scandals in Albany, whether it's related to, you know, finance, corruption, and in this particular case, you know, allegations of abuse and also alcohol and drug misuse. And I think that it's really having a corrosive effect on politics. But as of right now, I'm not entirely convinced that there's a lot of political will to clean up the system, because the folks involved in regulating the system are largely beneficiaries of the system.
Yeah, and I want to turn to Megan DeChanteau, who's the Director of Development and Marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. As I said, in our second half hour, we're going to talk a lot more about the specific dynamics of cases like this that we are seeing way too often. But I want to ask you, as someone who works with Willow, you need people in power to champion causes. This was supposed to be one of those people. Does that undermine your confidence in other men in power right now?
I was speaking just a minute ago with someone downstairs who shared with me that she feels demoralized by these allegations and by the situation. And my response to her was to don't be. Don't be demoralized. Be inspired. Be encouraged by the women who are coming forward. And I think it's not surprising at this point that people are shocked. by the allegations, because people who are abusive tend to be charming and wonderful and powerful people, and everyone around them likes them. And so we don't see this double life. The personal and the professional are very, very different. And someone who can appear to us professionally to be an ally for this cause and to have done so much good work in the field of domestic violence and to support women, to hear these allegations against him is incredibly disappointing. We thought he was one of the good guys. And does give us pause, I think, in looking around. But it's something we see every day, even here in Rochester, that we know there are people in power who are abusive in their personal lives. And professionally, we think they're wonderful.
Megan, can I also ask you, you know, I'm looking at just in the last 24 hours, Zephyr Teachout challenged Governor Cuomo in a primary in the last election, and she's been a prominent figure in New York State looking at other political runs. She's run for Congress, that kind of thing. And she tweeted yesterday, "I am seriously considering running for Attorney General. It is a major decision and will take real thought. For today, I'm grateful for the women who dared speak up against one of the most powerful men in the U.S. and for Barbara Underwood, the brilliant woman who will be acting New York Attorney General." I want to ask, I'll start with all of our guests. I want all of our guests to answer this. I'll start with Megan on this. Does the next AG need to be a woman?
I don't think I'd go so far as to say it needs to be a woman. I think that looking at someone's record is important, and also being able to judge their character. And when there are things behind the scenes we don't know about, as Karen was saying, it makes it difficult to be a good judge of character. There is nothing intrinsic about men that would make them more prone to being abusive. However, our culture has promoted that and allowed it, and in some cases encouraged that. And so it is true that the majority of abusers are men and the majority of victims are women, yet there's nothing about an individual man that would cause him to be abusive.
You know, Wes Renfro, historically, my brain goes all the way back to Susan B. Anthony and the effort of women to win the right to vote and to win the right to participate in politics. And one of the things that they heard all the time and that we have heard ever since even 1920 is that, well, you know, we don't have as many women in politics, but we've got a lot of allies. Well, Schneiderman was supposed to be an ally. And when you talk about, well, we don't have a lot of diversity on boards, but we have a lot of allies. Well, the LGBTQ community hasn't really been repped, but there are a lot of allies. Ultimately, allies are good if they're truly allies, but you still need real representation. And I think this is, we're starting to see this in New York State politics, or maybe I'm wrong. Disabuse me if I'm wrong on that. I'm not saying it has to be a woman in the next case, but there's a lot of powerful men in New York State politics, and there does appear to be a big disparity.
So I think there's two things. The first is that we need to remake politics so that it's attractive to marginalized people, including women. Right now, the rules very much induce men to participate, and that's not always true for other groups. I would also agree that I don't think it necessarily has to be a woman, that it should be a person of not only personal integrity and character, but also someone who has the professional resume to manage the truly astounding array of cases, including many prominent national cases that rest with the New York State Attorney General. Thankfully, however, I think that there are no shortage of women in New York State who fit both of those bills.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point here. It's not just a symbolic job. There's a lot of really important cases that are going to be. And Governor Cuomo has said this is not an office that's rudderless. There are really strong people still doing the work in the office. But when you say the culture has promoted men to sort of be the de facto people in these positions, what starts to change that? What do you see as possibly changing that?
So I think it's a series of across-the-board changes, not only in this particular office, but in political offices across the country. I think that starts with how we teach and educate young women about the possibilities that are open to them. I think it's about how we structure and incentivize or not rewards in terms of work-life balance and career advancement. Folks in my field have done a really good job of demonstrating that one of the prime reasons why women don't elect into office is because they don't believe that they can simultaneously manage that along with having a family. We need policies that promote that sort of equity. And those, I think, are really big structural across-the-board changes that need to happen.
Karen DeWitt, what are we hearing, whether it's Zephyr Teachout, Kathy Hochul, other names, what are we hearing in Albany about what we expect for the appointment to be and what the next election might look like for AG?
Well, I think, you know, politically, a lot of politicians think it's got to be a woman this time. But, you know, it just, I guess really it would be nice if it wasn't the token woman just because something bad happened in the Attorney General's office. And maybe there are just more of an array of credible women candidates. I mean, I think it's great that men are champions of women and women's rights, but I think, like, you know, women are starting to think, well, maybe we got to rely on ourselves just as much. And I think that's why the upstart candidacy of Cynthia Nixon, who's challenging Cuomo in the Democratic primary, why the media are taking her seriously, because there does seem to be a hunger for that kind of a candidate. And the reason why she was able to do it, she was a celebrity. She was very successful as an actress, so she doesn't have money worries. I had to look at her taxes. She has, you know, a domestic servant to do some of the work around the house, which a lot of women don't have. And she doesn't have that much to lose to do this. But there aren't that many women in her position that can say, you know what, I would like to try to do this. A lot of women, there's just so many considerations that hold them back. But it has struck me in the over 30 years that I've covered politics, why haven't I seen more candidates like this, you know, that are just kind of, maybe not, you know, normal, but kind of, you know, more women that seem credible. And I haven't seen a lot of them, really.
I see the phone starting to ring. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. And, you know, Karen, I'm looking at this New Republic piece, and they're reminding us of all of these scandals. Sam Hoyt, Hiram Montserrat, Senator Jeff Klein, who's still doing the work, the allegations against him.
Yes. There
are a long list, to say nothing of Elliot Spitzer and others, and Anthony Weiner and Donald Trump and all of these other names and politics, people who've come out of New York State in some form. There's a lot.
Yeah, and it's coming to a head because of the Me Too movement, and the women feel more supported that they can talk about those things. So we're hearing about things that have been going on for a long time, and it seems like that is not losing steam based on what happened this week with our now former attorney general.
We've got a few more minutes with Karen DeWitt, and I want to hit a subject that NPR in 2013, NPR's Alan Greenblatt, tried to answer a question. Why do corrupt people succeed in New York politics? Why do so many people, again, usually men, who end up being really corrupt, rise so high in the ranks of New York politics so often? And here is what Greenblatt wrote for NPR back in 2013. And I'm going to read this list, and I'll ask our guests what they think. Number one, it's effectively a one-party state with the Democrats so dominant that there is no political competition, and machine politics thus set the agenda. Number two, the elections are expensive, making candidates reliant on donors. Number three, many key decisions, such as the shape of the state budget, are made in backroom deals between just a few power players. Number four, the local media is so focused on national events that it ignores what's happening at the state, especially upstate level. And I'm going to disagree with that and point to Karen DeWitt's coverage. And number five, there's no anti-corruption movement to challenge the existing culture. Wes, do you think any of those line up in your mind and why we see so many corrupt people in New York politics?
I do, although I think that we need to be careful and not lump all types of corruption together with other types of bad behavior. You know, I think that there is certainly a strong culture of corruption in Albany, but the degree to which that is synonymous with other types of bad behavior, including the abuse of women or other egregious abuses of power, I would need to see more evidence to feel comfortable in saying that those are interchangeable. So I just think we should be careful with how we're describing the outcomes.
Okay.
I think corruption is probably an easier way to govern, as long as you don't get caught. Because, you know, you just pay people off, you have patronage jobs, and it's easier than actually, you know, dealing with things in, you know, maybe a more substantive way. And we don't really have any good state laws against these things. I mean, one of the reasons why the former legislative leaders are in trouble, and now Governor Cuomo's former top aide was convicted of bribery, is, you know, the federal government, the U.S. District Attorney Preet Bharara, used federal laws to go after them. There weren't really any state laws, and still aren't, that prohibit, you know, many of the things that they did.
All right, listeners, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. I want to hear from you on whether you feel cynical and maybe perhaps that you won't trust political leaders? I mean, does this shake your confidence in our political leaders that you think you know, but maybe what we're finding out is we often don't know people in power or in public positions? Does it change anything for you? Does it change how you might vote? Would you like to see more women in power in New York State? Or do you think that this is all sort of, you know, maybe missing the point? You can call the program and let us know, or you can email us connections@wxxi.org. Bonnie in Rochester, first up on the phone. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. Well, there's no real mystery here that for many, 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 many years, men have been in power. If you go back historically, it shouldn't be a surprise. You know, so the question is, been around a long time. There's been some movement on these things, but I think we just can't act as though this is, oh, this is something new. It isn't something new. And that makes it more frustrating, because why aren't we at a better place? We're maybe at a better place than we used to be, you know, 100 years ago. So one thing I would suggest with all this, that I remember not too many years ago where issues that were in the feminist realm were occasionally talked about in the public media. I rarely hear that except on discussions regarding universities and that such. So, because some of the basic causes of this, there's some of the ones that was listed already, but some of them are, how do men view themselves in a masculine way? What is the core? And a lot of times the core is, especially with white men, I'm better than you are. I want to be in charge. Now, they're not saying this out loud a lot of times, but this is, you know, so we have to look at oppression, which includes, you know, how racism, feminism, it includes a whole realm of things that we should be including in our education system from grade zero up. And that way we would have a better handle on and be able to understand these things at a better in a better way and be able to handle them and have higher expectations of people. The other thing I want to quickly say is, one of the things that is annoying to me about this is that it's disappointing with the Attorney General personally and collectively. Having said that, it's also very frustrating because, you know, I'm concerned that they're going to pick a woman, because that makes the governor look good, and they're going to pick a woman maybe who is just won't go after the governor. And I'm not saying everything the governor does is wrong. I'm just saying there's some things about the governor that need to be looked at a balance, or any other person. So are we going to pick somebody who really has a strong history on radical social justice, or are we going to pick somebody that we say, oh, here's a woman, look at me, I'm wonderful, and, you know, all the rest of it. Thank you.
Yeah, Bonnie, thank you. I want to work backwards there, and let's do this here. Wes and Karen, I want to hit that. I think Megan DeChateauvieux probably wants to weigh in on some of Bonnie's initial comments about what masculinity means in society. Let's work backwards. She's saying that she doesn't just want it, Wes, to be sort of you know, a machine party pick with someone who's going to be safe for the Democrats in power. What do you think?
I think that's a tough sell, given the realities of the process to replace the former attorney general. It's going to take 107 votes in a joint session, and I think about 103 or 104 of those are currently seated Democrats. And so this will largely be a replacement that's up to Democrats. And I think that if the governor has his way, that it will certainly take place either concurrently with or after the party gathering in 2 weeks. And I think that'll certainly give politicos in the Democratic Party a lot of say in who the replacement is.
Okay.
Yeah, the governor's got some ideas about who he might like in there, including his own counsel, who is a man, an African-American man, Alfonso David. There's also been, and this is just speculation around the Capitol, that he might want to park Kathy Hochul there, because he's kind of hinted that he didn't want her to be his lieutenant governor running mate anymore, saying perhaps she'd like to run against Chris Collins, the congressman in Western New York, and which Kathy Hochul said repeatedly, no, I don't want to do that. But there has been some call around here, but it's mostly from the opposing party, the Republicans, saying we have to have an independent attorney general, somebody who's not part of the political machine, and somebody who can just, you know, be, you know, a little bit independent of all these other people, all the other entrenched groups here.
Karen, right down to the second. It's 12:30. We got to let you go, but thank you for the work as always, and we'll be looking more for you this afternoon and every day right here on WXXI. Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen DeWitt is WXXI's Capitol Bureau Chief. And before we hit the break, let me ask Megan DeChateauvieux, you know, you heard Bonnie's comments there about what masculinity means, and I want to hear, you know, how you view that, especially in context of today's discussion.
Yes, I think men have had this abusive behavior for centuries, as Bonnie notes, and in the past they've tended to get away with it. And that's not the case anymore. There are women coming forward with these allegations, and men in powerful positions are falling. We have giants who are falling because of women's voices, and that's incredibly empowering. And I think the Me Too movement had a lot to do with that, with women seeing other women stepping forward. I think also that representation is incredibly important, and to have more women in positions of power in leadership and political leadership will change the course of history. I look at Cynthia Nixon, and I think that she is not your average woman. If we want to think about representation, I want to go outside of Albany, outside of New York. There's a woman running for governor of Maryland right now who's Krish for Maryland, and she is a progressive leader. She has an incredible background of working with the Obamas, but she is a child of immigrants, and her husband, I went to high school with him. He's a kid from Syracuse. They're just regular people. And she's able to come into this race for governor of Maryland with the tagline of no man can beat the incumbent Larry Hogan, but I'm no man, which is incredibly powerful for other women to see that. And her campaign materials include her infant, well, 6-month-old daughter. And so she's showing up as a mom, as a child of immigrants, as a regular woman who can say, I'm doing this and so can you.
In some ways, Megan is feeling inspired by that. But Wes, I don't know. I feel like the country's in this weird place where people are just accepting of corruption. And I'm not just looking at the White House in 2016. West Virginia did have an election yesterday, a primary election in which Don Blankenship did not win. The former coal baron, the CEO of Massey Energy, one of the first people I covered out of college. And I could probably spend hours talking about Don Blankenship. But suffice to say, he just got out of prison for a year in which he could have been in prison for 30 years. 29 miners died. And one of the reporters in West Virginia interviewed a guy about, well, would you vote for corrupt people? And the guy says, well, 3 of my cousins died in that mining accident. And I'm going to vote for Don Blankenship. And the reporter says, why? And the guy says, I want my crooked people to be honest. And Don Blankenship is an honest crook. And he voted for him. What is happening here?
You know, that sort of thinking isn't new or novel in American politics. It's important to remember.
It's not new or novel, you're saying.
No, it's important to remember that for, you know, protracted periods in American history, machine politics were prominent. And there's a deeply inculcated form of reasoning in American politics that suggests that all politicians are corrupt. And as long as they're corrupt and efficient, I'm willing to overlook their personal and professional foibles because I'm outcomes oriented. And I think that while that is a longstanding tradition, in recent years, it has become more pronounced, and I think more folks are willing to say that publicly, perhaps, than in previous times.
All right. Well, I don't know if that gives me hope or sadness, but Wes Renfro is giving some perspective. He's associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at St. John Fisher College. Megan DeChanteauvieux is director of development and marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. Carlene, Linda, please stay on the line, because what we're going to do is take our only break of the hour, and then we're going to turn the conversation wherever our listeners want to go. We're also going to talk about how we start to see more change coming. Willow has some thoughts on that as a domestic violence center in the light of the Me Too movement. So let's get that only break and come right back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, Frank DeBlaise joins us in studio. He's a longtime local music journalist, a photographer, and a Parkinson's patient. And his newest piece for City Newspaper takes a look at medical cannabis. He wanted medical marijuana as an option to treat his Parkinson's symptoms. He got the go-ahead from doctors, so how did it turn out? What did he learn about the process in New York State? He will explain next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A couple of listeners have been waiting. Let me start with Carlene in Rochester. Go ahead, Carlene.
Your last caller mentioned education of young men from the cradle on up. We have a situation here. I'm a senior citizen, and yet was raped in college by a brother of 2 clergymen. This is nothing new. This is decades old. What the situation is here, you have these abusive businesses built around torturous kinds of sex or violent kinds of sex, and everybody looks in the other direction. They don't have these shops because there's no one going to them. They're online. They're everywhere. And until we change the culture of how young men are raised and how we are able to, this man may be a great statesman, but he's practicing these things in his private life. How many other men in our community and youth are practicing the kind of sex that is overpowering or damaging to women? And it's the kind of thing that really doesn't get talked about until someone's in the hospital or a victim of a terrible crime. I'm more concerned with what are we going to do about that aspect of it than the fact that it's a big headline. Why don't we look at the fact of the sexuality that we're raising our children in?
Carlene,
thank you.
I'm so sorry about what you went through, Carlene. And first of all, thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts and experience there. I want to turn to both of our guests. I will say Eric Schneiderman has said that his defense is that he was role-playing and that he thought it was consensual role-playing, which seems to me to be the most lawyerly possible response if you have punched or slapped somebody and left physical bruises and marks, if you have threatened them, if you've said, I am the law, you can't leave me, you can't do this. The easiest possible parachute out of that later is to say, oh, I was just role-playing. We were just, that's kind of a catch-all to say I was never serious, and I don't think that anybody really is buying it. But regardless of that, you have Carlene saying that this has been the case. And Wes, during a brief break, you said that this has gone on, to Carlene's point, for many, many years, but you did see a little bit of a hinge point in history about how the public responds to these kind of comments, yes?
Yeah, so I was referencing the very famous case of William Kennedy Smith, in which he was brought up on rape charges and then, you know, famously claimed that it was an example of what he deemed rough sex. And at the time, I think the default position for folks all across the country was to believe him and not the victim. And I do think that something has shifted in that most of us are now willing to believe, with corroboration, the stories of victims in a way that perhaps we weren't willing to do so in the past.
Okay. Megan, do you agree with that?
I do. I think there's a long way to go still, but I do believe that victim blaming has decreased in the past maybe even 4 to 5 years. I think it's been very recent, and particularly with the Me Too movement and also with domestic violence. There's a particular hashtag, Why I Stayed, that came out in 2014, 2015, and that brought people forward to share their reasons for being in an abusive relationship and staying in an abusive relationship, and kind of helped to broaden the context and understanding of what that looks like, and so people could see why a victim wouldn't just leave or escape an abusive relationship. So I think the tides are turning, and I think the Me Too movement is huge.
All right. And Henrietta, this is Linda next on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And this is in reference to callers and the topic about how male sexuality and how masculinity gets shaped in our culture. And about a year or so ago, MCC showed a movie called Tough Guys, Guys being spelled G-U-I. S-E, and it was a powerful movie about how masculinity gets constructed here and the fears that are behind that construction and some of the anger behind that construction. And I hope there's some educators and superintendents out there listening, because I really feel this movie should be shown in every school district, much like we showed the movie I'm Not Racist, Am I? And we finally got a vocabulary about whiteness and race. I think that movie needs to be shown in school districts. There's a slightly edited version for more gentler audiences, but it was powerful. And my husband, being a white guy, just came out with this whole different understanding of how that's all going on. So please, somebody, show this movie, and it's called Tough Guys, G-U-I-S-E. Thank you.
Linda, thanks for the phone call. Megan, what do you think?
I think in terms of educating our youth, both boys and girls, we are doing them a disservice by not sharing enough information about promoting healthy relationships. And so we teach them all kinds of things, but very rarely do we as parents or as educators speak to them about what a healthy relationship looks like and what consent is and what that means, where you have a situation where someone might say yes one time, yes does not always mean yes every time. So even if this was a situation of role playing with the Attorney General, if that person said yes once, it doesn't mean it's always yes. And no always means no, and to teach our children that their bodies are sacred, their bodies are their own, and no one has the right to be anywhere near them, I think is really critical. And we can have all these messages about what to look for and the red flags, but we're not showing them what a healthy relationship actually can be. And the media is doing a terrible job showing that too. So you see romantic movies that portray stalking, that portray possessiveness and controlling and jealous behavior as romantic behavior, and that's not the case.
And you know, Megan, I've brought this up on the program in the past, but it's true that in some societies, 4 and 5 years old, they start teaching healthy relationships, most often in Scandinavian countries. And of course, some of the pushback is, well, you can't start teaching sex ed to 5-year-olds. They say, well, I don't know that it's really sex ed in the way that you're envisioning your high school years, but they are teaching healthy relationships, not just healthy touch, good touch, bad touch, but also what is a respectful relationship? What is a healthy relationship? Starting that young. Can we do that here? Should we do that here?
Willow Center is in every school district in Monroe County. We're in the health classes, mostly with the middle schoolers and high schoolers. We are in some elementary schools as well. And I think what I would say is that kids know. They're hearing it on the bus. They're hearing rumors from their friends as early as 4 and 5 years old. And so if they're hearing that from others, that may be misinformation, and we as parents and as educators should jump in there and try to correct that or help kids really to learn what a healthy relationship is and what is appropriate sex ed at those ages.
Hmm. All right, let me get back to your phone calls, and this is Manon in Rochester. Go ahead, Manon.
Hi, Evan. This is a great program. Evan, you said something about the corruption that people vote for corrupt politicians. So it does go two ways, like the politician is corrupt and there's these foolish people who vote for them. So corruption is continues and doesn't improve. Education is very important. And I think the continuum of violence and sexual images in television, cinema, media, and everywhere how people portray sex and women is very degrading, and children learn these things. There is a great book that we can educate women with. It's called How Girls Experience Race in America. Racism and sexism are part of culture, every culture, not just America. Thank you, Evan.
Yeah, thank you, Manon. I appreciate that. And listeners, if you want to join the conversation and follow up those or others, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're talking about the Eric Schneiderman story in The New Yorker that resulted in the resignation of New York State's Attorney General within just a few hours. He has denied the allegations that he did anything inappropriate, but he has resigned, and those allegations are obviously very serious. You can find them in The New Yorker now, and we're talking about that with Megan DeChanteauvieux, the Director of Development and Marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center, and Wes Renfro, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at St. John Fisher College. Here's Doug writing to the program and saying the following. Great conversation. One thing I've noticed is that at the national level among Democrats, the women leaders seem just plain tougher than the men. Whether it's Nancy Pelosi running the Democratic Party with an iron fist for years or Kirsten Gillibrand forcing Al Franken out, there's been a lot of discussion of violence among men, but there's another angle. Men letting, quote, boys be boys and going too easy on one another. And clearly in New York State on the corruption angle, men in both parties have decided to let everyone get away with it. Do you think it's possible that a female governor might be more likely to finally say enough is enough because she wouldn't be part of the old boys club? And I mean this in terms of both Me Too issues and also bribery and corruption issues. Wes Renfro?
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that. And there is a pretty good body of research that suggests that women once elected into public office do behave differently than their male counterparts. And so I'm pretty sympathetic.
Okay, and that's not to say you're not going to find your outlier cases, so please, listeners, don't just email me one case of one piece of corruption or assault, abuse. It does happen, and it does happen going in both directions, but we're mainly, again, focused on what is more likely reality. Or Megan DeChanteauvieux, maybe you don't like how I'm characterizing that, because I keep talking about sexual abuse or sort of sexual misconduct as if it's men against women. I know it can go the other way, yes.
We are talking a lot about
men against men and women against women.
Yes, yes. We are talking a lot about toxic masculinity, and it is true that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men will be a victim of domestic violence in their lifetime. So it is very prevalent among all demographics. It knows no boundaries. I think it's important to remember that abuse abuse is about power and control. And so it's a setup, a pattern of behavior to exert your power and control over your intimate partner. And I think that when you have people in positions of power who, you look at Harvey Weinstein, who is used to that, everyone doing their every whim, then to abuse that power, I think, is all too easy. And now we're saying enough.
I want to read an email from a listener named Herman, and I'll direct this to Megan Chateauvieux of Willow Domestic Violence Center. I hear this, I'm going to call it a complaint, a lot. And I never agreed with it, but I'm going to go ahead and read this because I hear this a lot, and I appreciate Herman sending a note expressing his thoughts. He says, quote, if aggressive, abusive men were consistently shunned by women, most of them would quickly change their behavior. Generally, those kind of men have no trouble getting dates and attracting women, perhaps because they are seen as masculine, so they behave in a way that gets them what they want, while typically nice guys are less popular with women and are seen as less exciting. End quote. It's Herman emailing the program. I hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. Let's unpack it. Well, first of all, what do you think, Megan?
That's a loaded one. We do hear that a lot as well. I think it's important to remember that abusers are incredibly charming people. They are wonderful, and who wouldn't want to date them? Typically, it's someone that you meet, you think is attractive, you want to go out with, you start dating. What happens is when you get to a point where there's any kind of commitment, where you decide that you will be monogamous, where you decide you'll move in together, when you get married, when you have a child, when there's a commitment that's made, that's when the abuse tends to start and to escalate. And so women don't go out looking for an abusive partner. They don't scan the room and think, that's the guy I want to date because he looks tough and mean and he's going to abuse me. That's never anything any woman has ever said. And so in that situation, my response to Herman is that just doesn't happen. Women don't go seeking out abusive partners. It happens after you have commitments, after you have some relationship, and that abusers start out wonderful and charming.
Okay. That sounds, I think that's sensical. And Herman, I've heard that construction a lot, that the nice guys never win. I don't think that's true. And I think Megan's point there is an important one, because they all seem like nice guys until you make that commitment. Or maybe Herman would feel otherwise. But I think it's important also to note one other point of his email, which is that he says, if aggressive, abusive men were consistently shunned by women, most of them would quickly change their behavior.
Well, women don't know. And when you're walking into it, you don't know what you're getting into until it's too late. And so if we as women are called upon to fix the men who are behaving badly, that's not fair.
Yeah, I don't know, Herman, if research suggests that what you're saying there is true, that men who abuse would just simply change. Getting men, reforming abusers is really complex and hard, isn't it, Megan?
Well, you look at this situation with Attorney General Schneiderman, and he has four women coming forward with allegations. That those are multiple years, I believe, of situations where he has been the abuser and been powerful. So even if one woman says, I'm, you know, not going to be with you, and finds an escape plan and finds her way out, which can be incredibly difficult, then there's another one that he will be targeting next.
All right, let me get Shauna in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Shauna.
Hi, I'm just saying it can be awfully difficult for children to sort it all out if mom and dad are not in a healthy relationship. It's much easier if the parents can say, we would never hit each other or whatever, and the child knows that that's true. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you, Shauna. Some thoughts on that, Megan?
We have 25 children in our shelter right now. Today, that's a typical number, between 25 and 30 kids. And we look at these children as an opportunity to help support them through the crisis they're experiencing, and also to kind of reframe their ideas of what a healthy relationship looks like. So they come to us from homes that are violent and abusive, and we have this chance with them to show them something different, to share with them what a healthy relationship can look like. Domestic violence is a learned behavior. We, in our shelter, see that we are raising the victims or perpetrators of abuse in the future if we don't do something about it today.
I want to turn back to Wes Renfro, who's given us a lot of good historical context to that. In some ways, we are seeing real change in the way victims are believed and people who make allegations are believed. But in terms of the way voters might still support corrupt politicians or people who are prone to corruption or people who have had scandals, that is nothing new. And so what I want to ask you is what you think really is going to be the ingredient to make a real change in Albany. So we're not sitting here in 5 or 10 years going, boy, we're still the most corrupt state. We have the highest level of per capita payouts using taxpayer money in abuse scandals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to throw it back, Wes, some people would say we should have just done a constitutional convention, you know, open the whole thing up. But we're not going to do that. And I'm trolling a little bit when I say that to Wes. But I want to ask you what you think really is going to be the ingredient to change it.
Well, first of all, you read my mind about the constitutional convention. You know, I don't think that there's one single change, but rather a sort of package of changes. I think it includes, you know, really rigorous reporting so that the citizens of the state are aware about the problems. I think it also means that we should have some increased legislation vis-a-vis ethics laws, not only on financial misdeeds, but certainly on issues that we might call character. I think both those are solely lacking in terms of regulation at the level of the state government. And then I also think that fundamentally the people of the state need to start having some discussions among themselves, right? And this is borne out in the research, but most folks really come to politics with a tribal lens. And we are very individually quick to dismiss charges, often, not always, against people of our particular tribe. You know, we might think about Bill Clinton, for example, in the 1990s. And I think one interesting thing that has to happen is that folks have to own that they have some responsibility to government, that it's not only that we receive rights and benefits. And part of that, from my perspective, is us being very clear-sighted and being skeptical and sometimes, you know, punishing people with whom we agree.
I think that is such a powerful point. And I did hear from a listener earlier this morning who said, oh, well, you're going to talk about it? Well, you're going to talk about the fact that these are all Democrats? And I said, first of all, look at my cheeky tweet about the New Yorker. It was the New Yorker, you know, a quote-unquote liberal publication with another story. First on Weinstein was a big Democratic donor, and now Schneiderman, a big Democratic hero in the political scene. His career is gone. And so to Wes's point, voters and citizens, we've got to be able to get away from tribalism and say that when this happens, it happens. And if it's on, quote unquote, our team, well, we should reexamine what it means to be on a political team to begin with. But to be honest about not just having motivated reasoning and whether we believe victims or not. And to the listener who got in touch with me this morning to say, look, it's all Democrats. I want to point out an important distinction lately. And this is just an observation. Since October, since the Weinstein story in the New York Times and the New Yorker came out, more cases involving politicians have seen the following dynamic. When it's a Democrat, the Democrat resigns pretty quickly under pressure from their own party. Al Franken, Eric Schneiderman, we could probably name others. When it is a Republican, that does not happen. Donald Trump, the Missouri governor, Eric Greitens, I believe. I mean, look up the charges against the allegations against Eric Greitens. Remarkably harrowing stuff. And he's not going anywhere. So what do you think, Wes?
There's a really great piece that came out in The Atlantic yesterday. It's a short piece. It's by David Graham, and he's essentially arguing this, and he says that Schneiderman's very quick resignation is a function of the fact that he was really beholden to other decision makers in the party, and he implies strongly that Donald Trump and some other Republicans who have run on outsider platforms aren't really capable of being punished by their peers from within the party. And so I do think there's something to that argument. It's a fascinating read.
Where is that again?
It's from The Atlantic from May 8th.
All right, that definitely worth checking out. And I want to ask Megan Chateauview from Willow before we close the hour about these four women, two of which were willing to put their name in publication despite their own fears of what happens. There's a lot of fear that people who have been abused have, understandably so. What is the message for any person, usually a woman, but any person who's in a relationship where they're told you cannot leave? You cannot leave, and maybe their sexual partner is someone with a lot of power. In this case, Eric Schneiderman, of course. The allegations saying things like, I am the law, you cannot leave. They're fearful either for their own physical safety or their reputational safety. That's very, very difficult. And what would you say to people, no matter what their background is, if they're ever in that position?
I would first encourage them to call our hotline. It's 222-SAFE for support in creating a safety plan. I would also say that those threats tend to be real. This morning I spent some time at the beginning of a murder trial for a woman who was murdered by her boyfriend back in December here in Rochester. And it does happen all too often in our community. And I think that the most important thing to do is when you are considering leaving an abusive relationship to make sure that you talk with someone and have a safety plan ready. We have orders of protection are provided by the courts. We can get you into our emergency shelter where there's safety and security. The police are incredible allies. I think it's important to know that you have options and that our counselors are available to walk through them with you.
And by the way, to be a little bit more charitable, whether he deserves it or not, to Eric Schneiderman, I will just ask you, because Wes used an important word earlier. When we are seeing the tide change and how the media reports these allegations and how the public responds to them, we do need some kind of, as much as we can have corroboration. But that means different things. And I think in many of these really well-sourced and reported cases, we see a lot of corroboration. And we do in the Schneiderman case, too. Do you put any credence in his defense of himself, that this was just role-playing, all consensual?
I think it comes back to the issue of consent, and that yes does not always mean yes.
Okay, well, I made my opinion known in that earlier this hour. I think it's very lawyerly. And
I agree.
He was the top lawyer in the state. But we'll see what happens to him. He has resigned, and I want to thank our guests for taking the time to work through these questions. Megan DeChateauvieux is Director of Development and Marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. People want to get in touch with Willow one more time. How do they do that?
It's 585-222-SAFE. It's 585-222-7233.
222-SAFE. Thank you for being here, Megan.
Thank you.
Wes Renfro is the chair of the Department of Political Science at St. John Fisher College. Always good to have your expertise and your context. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.